Somebody like Michael Saylor, who personally holds around something like 20,000 Bitcoins, and he's already publicly announced that his donation is actually going to be back to the Bitcoin network. So when he dies, his Bitcoin will permanently pulled out of circulation. So he's sort of giving forward the gift of scarcity. And I wonder how many people will follow his suit. The idea of donating a gift to charity that could grow in perpetuity is probably the ambition of every charitable gift giver. And it's a problem that Bitcoin can solve, but what needs to happen first is some changes to the way that laws work in most countries in the world. It's a conversation we're having this week with our special guest, Andrew Klubein, who is a lawyer specializing in charity and nonprofit. I'm Scott Dietles. I'm the CEO and founder of Block Rewards, and part of our mission in bringing Bitcoin to the workplace is helping people understand how it will help them. Bitcoin has a role to play in the future of helping charities survive. And today we are looking at some ideas about exactly how. Hope you enjoy. All right. Welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. This week we are joined by special guest Andrew Klubein. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me.
We are, a lot of different places we could go with the conversation today. You're a lawyer by trade and a Bitcoiner closet Bitcoiner came out.
That's right. There are a few of us around.
Maybe just for the benefit of our guests, if you could tell us a little bit about yourself before we get started.
Sure. Yes, I'm a lawyer for the philanthropic sector. So my clients are almost exclusively charities, not-for-profits, donors, and foundations. Pretty kind of normie education, if you want to put it that way. Like, I went to undergrad, worked a year, went to law school, and my Bitcoin interest and journey was in parallel with school, but sort of separate entirely from my legal interests and law career. So I've been working to build my own charities and not-for-profit practice with Outsiders Law for a couple of years now. And by the time this airs, I will have wrapped up there. And only in the last year or so have I been sort of exploring how I've been into Bitcoin for a little while, but only the last year or so I've been exploring how it touches my practice and how my practice can grow and expand a little bit to consider Bitcoin for clients.
Very cool. So maybe before we go there, how was it that you started to understand Bitcoin? Maybe what's your Bitcoin origin story?
So I remember in high school, which would have been really early days of Bitcoin, coming across this like magic internet money thing. So I have a couple of vivid memories of like stumbling on the original Hotmail or MSN, you know, ads about when it went from, I don't know what it would have been, cents to a dollar, that sort of thing. So it was it was a blip on the radar really early on. And then at some point, sort of in maybe 2014-ish, my brother was like, hey, like you should actually look at this thing. And so sure enough, you know, he sent me the white paper. My eyes sort of glazed over after the first page. I was interested, but felt sort of, you know, too stupid to understand it. Not really technical. My background is like literature and philosophy, so humanities. Which, you know, now I realize I should have really taken a look. But at the time it was like, you know, I'm not a software engineer. And then it just sat for a while. He sort of dabbled a little bit. I don't think anybody bought anything. 2017 rolls around. I watched on the sidelines, but got really interested. 2018. Started taking a little more seriously and was like, oh, this is really worth paying attention to. So my journey kind of actively probably started in about 2018. But at that point, I was in law school, you know, focused sort of on the corporate ladder thing. Was at a good law school, got recruited into a big firm out of law school. So Bitcoin was of interest, but other things I thought that needed my attention. And 2000, and correct me if the year is wrong, 2001, there's 2021 when Bukele makes the announcement about Bitcoin being legal tender in El Salvador. I think it was spring.
Yeah, I think so.
I think it was April 21. So I'm actually Salvadoran, born in El Salvador. My mom's Salvadoran, grew up in Canada because my dad's Canadian, and I have a Salvadoran passport, but you know, like it's been in a closet and was expired, you know, sitting in my drawer for years. And, you know, like I said, I've been paying attention somewhat to Bitcoin from about 2018. 2021 rolls around, this announcement is made, and my brothers and I are texting going, whoa, suddenly our passport's like pretty cool. You know, sure enough, eventually it becomes the $1 million passport and they're sort of selling it. Now they're giving it away to whatever it is, architects and philosophers that they want to come help out here. I'm in El Salvador with my parents right now. But that really, I mean, that kind of lit the fire, right? It went from being this thing that was super interesting, that I was beginning to understand, you know, what we mean when we say this is better money, to now I've got skin in the game because this country that I'm born in, I'm a citizen of, has hitched its wagon to the state for better or worse, right? So it even became, you know, at the time I wasn't maybe, I still had those doubts about, oh, this thing can still go to zero and that sort of thing. But the announcement that it became legal tender was almost the point where that didn't matter anymore, because now it's mine. Like, my fortune is sort of, my lot is sort of in with El Salvador's. So from that point, which was fairly early in my legal career, is when I really started to wrestle with, okay, I need to pay attention to this. I need to be watching what's going on in El Salvador, trying to wrap my head around Bitcoin. And that happened in parallel sort of as my career progressed. And only recently, like I mentioned, have those two things started to dovetail.
Yeah, we met in El Salvador. And that was my first trip down there. It was November of 2024. It was a really incredible experience to see. I think for people who are Bitcoin skeptical, and I say this a lot, it's like, especially in Canada or even in the United States, Australia, you can't pay for your Starbucks with Bitcoin. And so a lot of people, you know, Bitcoin outsiders have this impression that like Bitcoin is not happening, or, you know, and then you go to El Salvador, you know, we get off the plane, pay for our visas at the airport in Bitcoin. We paid for our cab to get to the hotel in Bitcoin. We paid for our dinner that night with Bitcoin. Like, and then it just went on and on. And not at all to give people the impression that like El Salvador has mastered Bitcoin and everyone understands what it is. But you mentioned it as money. It certainly is something that is being used as money in El Salvador, like without a doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's an expectation thing, right? If you show up expecting this place to be Bitcoinized, Bitcoin standard, you're going to be disappointed, right? There's a whole education piece. There's also a dynamic that foreigners don't have always understand of most of the population basically is like sustenance living, right? They do not have the capacity to save, right? They need everything they make to spend. And so to save in Bitcoin over the short term when your life is denominated in dollars makes no sense. So of course there's no uptake there. But if you come with an expectation of, you know, I hold Bitcoin in Canada and can't use it for anything, and you're at the airport and a couple of places in the city and then down at the beach, and like, you can be pretty impressed that there are all sorts of places, you know, from roadside restaurants to very nice places that are happy to take your Bitcoin. And it's pretty fun. But the first spend is like, I remember, I think I was in El Sante when I visited several years ago, and I bought pupusas. I think that was the first time I paid in Bitcoin. And it was this like, wow, it reminded me of the first time I got in a car and hit the gas. It was like, I've seen these things from the outside, but from the inside, like, I'm doing it. You know, it was, it's pretty cool. So there's a reason, I guess, it's been a mecca for people to come see what actually spending or living on Bitcoin is like.
Yeah, I think it's a glimpse into the future. And I mean, it's a really exciting experiment, even if, you know, continual tweaking required.
Yeah, especially after that, the IMF agreement. I'm not familiar with the details, but it seems that the government's going to either wind down or hand off, probably the latter, Chivo. Which in the long run is probably going to be good. You know, for, I think people have commented on that, saying this is the government capitulating for a loan. Like, they know what they're doing. the consequence on the ground for Bitcoin uptake is pretty minimal. So, you know, slowly but surely, I think it's growing here. There's a lot of internal resistance, but it'll do what it does. People will pay attention.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess like speaking to the complexities even of just like enacting a law or a policy, and then, you know, that's one thing, but the practical reality of these things, particularly in countries where infrastructure may just not be quite as streamlined as we see call it the first world, the more developed countries. So
totally, it's absolutely an issue, and it's an issue, you know, like as a lawyer, like we see this stuff all the time. Government passes policies or even policy ideas, and then there's the problem of implementing, or of interpreting, or of actually applying it to a particular case. And you're right, when it comes to like payment infrastructure here, that the law, it wasn't enforced, right? And it wasn't intended to be enforced, but on paper, the law said everybody must accept Bitcoin. Like, on paper, most of the country was non-compliant, right? They're not going to go out and enforce that. It was sort of a law with the intention of promotion. But the same sort of stuff happens at home, right? So in Canada, we just passed this, or they floated the idea, which never actually got put fully into law, about the increase on capital gains inclusion rates from 50% to 2/3. And now with this mess of parliament being prorogued and all the bills being scrapped, we're seeing, okay, this wasn't actually turned into law. And then you have the same, the sort of a similar implementation problem, a bunch of uncertainty around it, CRA saying they're still going to enforce, like, these messes on the intent of a policy, like you said, versus, okay, how is this actually going to roll out in real life? It's a chasm that people, especially who live in the government policy world, maybe, like, it's more convenient to ignore. And even lawyers and colleagues of mine, you know, we like to at least wish it wasn't there. It makes our lives harder. But there's certainly a lot more gray. And I deal with that as far as Bitcoin related to my practice. I think there are, how Bitcoin is regulated, for example, in Canada, I'm a Canadian lawyer, is pretty clear. And yet there are sort of questions around how you might deal with it in any particular instance. And there are choices that professional advisors have around, you know, how conservative or aggressive you may want to be, or your client might want to. Sorry, I think I just pivoted that into into another part of the conversation. I don't know if you want to go there quite yet.
Yeah, no, that's great. You know, maybe just to start on like a 50,000 feet level, you see comments, and I think most of these comments are kind of disingenuous, but even just last week, Jamie Dimon, head of JP Morgan Bank, makes a comment, something to the effect of like, I wish they would just make it illegal, referring to Bitcoin. And let's start there. And from a legal standpoint, I guess it depends on the country you're listening in. But I mean, Bitcoin itself has a lot of attributes about it that would make an outright, making it illegal, it would be not a very simple task.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many layers to this sort of thing. You can sort of go to the legal and the political, and then I think you can peel it even further back and get a little more philosophical about it. And you really get into the question of what's government for, and maybe even like, what is a nation like for whom, and at what sort of level ought this thing be made illegal? And like, clearly we've seen in the developed West that governments see themselves as intended to be actively like crafting the environment in which their subjects live, right? And defining borders and, you know, opening them or closing them, or making something illegal and not, and imposing, you know, one digital currency that's centralized and, you know, outlawing another. And, you know, you can criticize somebody like Diamond at the policy level of like, this is stupid because frankly, it's impossible. Like, you can't regulate this thing. That's a reasonable criticism. But I think you can also pull it up and say that view and understanding of government, in a sense, is what's gotten us into the shit show we're in post-war, and maybe before that, but certainly more recently. Bitcoiners, I think, by default, there's a significant overlap between Bitcoiners and the people who sort of share the sort of criticisms that I just outlined. My hope in the Bitcoin space is there will be a bigger effort into translating that for normies, right? Because some people will be immediately turned off by, you know, the sort of sovereign individual sort of mindset, or they go, it's simply incompatible with, you know, Western governments, that sort of thing. Well, you know, it sort of depends what take you have on it, what you understand sort of sovereignty at the individual level to mean, and at the government level to mean. I think those things can coexist to a certain extent. And I think you're seeing that with somebody like Bukele in El Salvador, right? It's a different governance project here, where the answer, as opposed to what Diamond is asking for, of like, this thing that we are scared of and threatens our very existence, you know, like, or at least threatens his interests, ought to just be eliminated. This is like Western medicine too, right? Problem, like, cut it out. Rather, you know, the approach in El Salvador has been integrate somehow with this thing that is emergent and we admit we cannot control, and we actually see some upside on. There are lots of bumps. It's not perfect. But the approach, I guess what I'm trying to say is that Diamond versus Bukele on Bitcoin is not just about Bitcoin. It's about how we understand government and our relation to it as people. Pretty distinct approaches.
Yeah, it's a really interesting, I mean, like, I guess some of a lot of what you're talking about would be maybe assigned to sort of a libertarian perspective, and which is a word itself that does turn certain people off right away, and others thinking like, oh, this is impossible, this is a pipe dream. Yeah, I agree with you. I think we have like really seen the pendulum shift, particularly in the last 5 years, over what is the purpose of the state, you know, from state lawmakers, maybe even themselves, feeling a little bit handsy with.
Yeah, no doubt. And it's funny to say, you know, like libertarian, that's certainly, you know, I think I outlined some arguments that are pretty aligned. I'm, you know, at a personal, like philosophical level, quite far from a libertarian, though I think I share a lot with them. My approach is kind of more, some people I call it distributist or subsidiarity driven or something, like where governance is really necessary, but it's at a local level, right? Like at the lowest level sort of capable of governing something should be the one allowed to govern it. And things shouldn't be sort of like pushed up from, let's say, the local council level up to federal government if at the local level you can deal with it. And El Sonte is a great example for that. Again, it's not a town that like runs fully on Bitcoin, but you have a bunch of people who got together and decided sort of organically to some extent, there's a currency here we can use. Great. Good for them. Like, and it's really cool to see that the government embrace that. Whereas in other places, you know, you'd have CRA or the IRS running after them and going, you know, who are like, imagine if the Hutterites or the Mennonites or, you know, some sort of colony did that, you know, the government would be, tax regulators would be in for their pound of flesh saying, you know, you can't do this. But, you know, a distributist or someone who's interested in local governance goes like, why not? This is sort of like local commerce. Why can't these people sort of govern this? Oh, because it threatens your monopoly on violence or whatever, whatever it is that they feel is threatened. So yeah, my angle on it is more communitarian in that regard. But I think it's really interesting to see how people coming from my perspective actually really overlap with libertarians in a lot of ways. Like it's a common, I don't want to say enemy, but maybe it is enemy, right? in sort of big government overreach at these highest levels where, you know, frankly, sort of the globalization or the pushing up of governance suffocates like both the individual and sort of local community, local culture, local expression.
Yeah. And it's sort of I think we are nearing an inflection point as sort of the big government and big tech merge more and more every day. And this is, for me, you know, part of what is exciting about Bitcoin is at least presents sort of a glimmer of a future where, you know, ordinary people have some say in how things are.
Yeah, no doubt. That's a little bit what I'm seeing in my practice and with clients and sort of the type of clients that both I've found myself talking to more recently and I want to be talking to more recently is, you know, as lawyers, we represent clients that come to us and you know, sometimes there are deep divides and you know, as professionals, we're both entitled and encouraged to say no, someone else might serve you better. Generally, our doors are pretty open, but I think we each try to curate practices that align with our values, and that's really what I'm feeling. And I'm seeing lots of interest from, let's say, groups like private schools that have of parents who would very much share sort of the discussion we just had and then have similar concerns, but kind of from the perspective of parents in their communities going, you know what, somebody's got to do something and it's going to be me. And we're going to strike up a group of parents and start a school together. And they may or may not be Bitcoiners, but the ethos is quite similar. And that's sort of one of the overlaps I'm beginning to see in sort of my thought along a Bitcoin journey and my practice.
You know, there's just such an interesting thing as we think about these big entrenched governments sort of growing in their maybe power and overreach. And then you have a country like El Salvador, and I'm sure there will be others that follow. And it is already, it's not to say that it's millions and millions of people, but there are already people that have made a decision to give up their life, cushy life in San Francisco or wherever, and move to El Salvador. And I mean, we were meeting those people at the conference we were at. So I guess my question and coming back to you, we now have this form of property and money that is borderless and does sort of like promote maybe a potential for a form of choice on the part of the consumer, where the consumer is a citizen of where they choose to park their life. And not everybody wants to leave, but it's like, if the threat of leaving is real or real enough, I think maybe that's the interesting part of an engine where the state may not have a choice about how they listen to this or how they might think about the Jamie Dimon route of we're going to try to make this illegal or ban it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think the reason you're seeing places like El Salvador, and there are other examples as well, but generally speaking, not the developed West embrace it, is because they have less to lose, right? They have more to gain. You know, this is a country with sort of middling tax rates. It's not like, wouldn't be on the map as appealing to someone seeking to sort of do jurisdictional arbitrage. But once Fratellis to Bitcoin comes into play, there's a competitive advantage. And so, you know, you've got kind of other islands or developing countries or whatever who really only stand to gain. Whereas I think it'll be a lot slower in places like Canada and the States. I mean, they're still active, you know, fighting against Bitcoin in a lot of ways in Canada, though we'll see if, I don't know if the next election will change that or not. I think people are really hopeful it will, but I'm not so sure the policy change will be as quick as we think. It would just be such an about face of years of policy to all of a sudden throw the doors open to Bitcoin. And the, frankly, government, media, and traditional finance have done a pretty good job at villainizing Bitcoin. I don't see that turn happening very quickly in a place like Canada. Although maybe that's exactly the reason there seem to be disproportionately like so many Canadian Bitcoiners, right? Because those who have sort of clicked into this and sort of and lived in that environment and seen the light, so to say, are really passionate about it and are ready to like build on it, you know, despite, for example, really poor tax treatment right now. So I think, and you talked to John Tellis, who I'm working on our Generatio project with, talked to a lot of people that are, you know, sort of asking about the jurisdictional arbitrage thing. I think in a lot of ways, it comes down to personal stuff. It doesn't actually come down to Bitcoin. Bitcoin's a really big element and a really big motivator, and people don't want to be taxed on it, or they want their wealth to be safe. But at the end of the day, I think what really makes you choose to cross a border is often your, like, the matrix of personal things going on in your life. Bitcoin is rarely actually the determinative one, even if it feels like it is. It's often representative of other sort of personal political commitments or something like that.
Yeah, and I would say even subjectively, that's as true of anybody I met who had made that choice to relocate to El Salvador. It's everything that comes with the decision to embrace Bitcoin. You know, you had mentioned, like, one of the most interesting presentations that I saw down there was the conversation around how sort of the Bitcoin ethos is actually changing the way the El Salvador in government is thinking about how they deliver healthcare.
Oh, I missed that one.
Yeah, so
I remember seeing it though. It looked good.
Yeah, it was great. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, it's a certain mindset that is going to be attractive to a certain percentage of people. And it's at least like, yeah, this idea of if it's an available option, it's on the table. So you have a specialty in your practice that, so you were saying, with sort of nonprofit and philanthropy endowments. I think that there is a very potentially interesting application for Bitcoin in that space. Maybe you could just, you know, what is that opportunity? Why would Bitcoin be of interest for charities and nonprofits?
You know, I think the immediate, there are two immediate places where it solves problems, sort of at an operational level, and then there's sort of like a bigger picture take. The immediate problems it can solve, one is cost of money transfer, where charities and not-for-profits doing work abroad pay extortionary fees to places like Western Union. And that's the same problem that El Salvador had, for example, with remittances coming from the States back home, of double digit, like way more than double digit percentage cuts being taken off. And in the context of charities in particular, that's a big problem, actually, because if it costs you 20% of what you're sending to send money to whatever, India, then that's a 20, like you're literally losing 20% of what your donors, for example, gave you and entrusted you with to, frankly, a predatory third party. So, you know, obviously, we know that Bitcoin can, you know, it can be moved a lot quicker, a lot more efficiently, more transparently at like pennies. So that's one problem it can solve. And there's a whole like little brand problem to solve, because as I mentioned, you know, Bitcoin's been villainized. And I think that's especially true in the philanthropy and not-for-profit space that has typically a pretty progressive leaning. And so there's a skepticism of, well, isn't this an asset that's used for money laundering and stuff? It's like, well, you know, if we're concerned about that, we should stop using US dollars. But that does have to be surmounted. I think, and I've got a couple people I've been chatting with actually who are interested. I just want to guide them through the Bitcoin transaction, right? And to have an agent on the other side that is, you know, able to use a Bitcoin wallet that is, you know, you've got all sort of the legal things papered and in place and necessary, but to just say, okay, we're going to send half of your transfer on Western Union and half of your transfer on Bitcoin. And we'll just, you know, we'll see how the experience works. So that's one. And number two, which I think is maybe possibly able to be taken up quicker, is Bitcoin as an endowment asset. So there's a lot of talk sort of around Bitcoin and business, having Bitcoin as a treasury asset. the equivalent in a charity would be having Bitcoin as endowment asset. Principles are the same. This is something that's appreciating against, you know, the Canadian dollar. Let's say, using Canadian charities as an example, you couldn't have a better savings account to preserve the longevity of your charitable cause. And that's a big problem in the sector right now. The pandemic killed all sorts of charities, put a whole bunch more on their deathbed. And the model of charities ask donors for money and then charities do good things is going to be dead really quick because cost of living, donors are donating less, you know, frankly, boomers are dying. A lot of stuff is going to get rolled into endowments. So it will be capital. It won't be income. And charities who are relying on 40, 50, 80% donations are just going to die. Like, and they really need to understand it that clearly. Like boards need to understand that. Executive directors need to understand that. And they need to be looking around for what a solution is going to be. Either you pivot and find yourself, you know, kind of an angel donor and stop relying on small donations. You pivot your model so that you're relying on tech and AI, for example, and less on staff. And then part of what I think should be a rational question for not even Bitcoiners who are in the charitable space, but just everybody in the charitable space is assets that appreciate against the dollar, at least. And Bitcoin stands out very obviously as one. Again, there's sort of some PR work to be done, like within the sector about that. And we have a big legal problem there because trustees of charitable property are supposed to be, they're held to a standard of a prudent investor. Well, who determines what a prudent investor is? Well, it's case law, it's the courts. And in some jurisdictions, there's actually a prescribed list of what's considered a prudent investment. And you can bet Bitcoin's not on that, right? So we're in this sort of space of an emergent legal question of, is Bitcoin considered an asset that a prudent investor would invest in? Well, ETFs, recent reports from places like, you know, BlackRock and Vanguard and that sort of thing are really helpful actually for that legal argument to say, well, yeah, at least part of your portfolio. I mean, you know, maybe the courts might decide 100% allocation of a charitable endowment to Bitcoin is stupid. We might have to contend with that for now. But a partial allocation, it's becoming the norm in terms of recommending at the personal level, at the business level. And as far as I'm concerned, charities are next.
Yeah, your last point in particular, it just makes so much sense to me. And, you know, thinking about these organizations' like mission to endure with stability into the long-term future, like Bitcoin is the thing that is, it's so obvious. Yeah.
Well, and that's a really important thing for Bitcoiners to understand. And this plays in a little bit to the work that John and I are doing with Generatio. On the Bitcoin family office sort of idea, there are two sort of phases, right? There's the planning phase, sort of you like plan for your death, estate plan, that sort of thing. And then there's, okay, like that's sort of dealt with. And now you've got assets you can leverage what you want to do with those. And we've had some clients really interested in this question of, you know, being a Bitcoin philanthropist or something to that effect, or leveraging Bitcoin. It might be using Bitcoin. It might be lending your Bitcoin for some good. They're really, like, it's really important for Bitcoiners, especially those who have quite a bit, to understand this, because those with the money will have the power in a sense, right? Like if Bitcoin becomes an endowment asset for charities and it begins to become at least understood in the sector, if not like a dominant mode of holding your endowment, well, whoever's holding a lot of Bitcoin is going to determine which charities are going to win in that sort of war for this new asset. And right now we've got a charitable sector that is drowning like in government funds. So the charitable sector, you know, like in historically, we could go back like 400 years, we could do the whole history of like charity in Britain, but it was like charity regulation recognized individual and community sort of giving and good. And you sort of saw need in your community and like groups of people organize themselves around that. Well, what we've seen post-war with the rise of the welfare state is government has, I wouldn't use the word co-opted because I don't even think it's all that intentional. It's just sort of the way, you know, Leviathan like slouches left, like it's just the way the cookie has crumbled, is that so much funding in the charitable sector actually comes from government, whether directly or indirectly. And the consequence is that the programming, the ideological bent, the sort of spirit of the sector is largely dominated by those funds. But if our monetary standard is going to change in the sector, or at least the standard of how we save or what the endowment assets are, there's a big role to be played by whoever happens to be holding those coins right now.
What would need to happen for, you know, I guess there would be sort of the tax status of the donation itself and then receiving the tax status of holding it for, like, maybe just an overview of how you see the issue.
Yeah. So in Canada, at least right now, any movement of Bitcoin is a taxable event. So that would include a donation of Bitcoin, let's say from you to a charity. There is an exception in the case of stocks. So if you donate a publicly traded stock, certain conditions to a charity, we're presuming that you've had a gain over the time that you've held the stock, but you're actually exempt from capital gains tax on that. You're not exempt if it's Bitcoin, but I think the policy solution very clearly is to just exempt Bitcoin as well. So that if you bought a whole coin at 50,000 and then you donated at 200,000, there'd be a massive tax bill. But the principle of the tax of the capital gains exemption is to say, well, you're actually directing these funds to something that the government itself considers to be a public good in a charitable activity. And so I think the argument is pretty simple that Bitcoin should be treated the same way a public stock is in that regard. Now, there's a lot of friction to getting to that point. But in terms of a policy solution, that would open the floodgates in terms of Bitcoin being used in the charitable sector. For now, the best advice you can give is kind of for donors to self-deduct. Like, if you want to give in Bitcoin and you're concerned about the tax consequence, sort of deduct it on the front end and just figure out what the net is that you want to be coming out of your pocket. And, you know, does that mean the charity ends up with a smaller donation? Yes, but it's bigger than zero. Like it's one of those, like, don't let the tax tail wag the investment dog, right? Like, don't not make the donation just because there are going to be bad tax consequences. If you really want to make it, and you also really want to make it in Bitcoin because you think that it is worthwhile for this particular charity or cause to have that as an asset, then, you know, just kind of deal with the regulations as they are for now and get them going on their journey. Like, it's quite a philanthropic thing to do in like the purest sense of the word, right?
Totally. Is there like a jurisdiction, you know, United States, Europe, or otherwise, where they have done a more friendly exemption as it relates to Bitcoin and charities? Or
so I don't know the answer to that question, and that's sort of been one of the places I've been meaning to go in my research on this stuff. As you know, I'm turning a little more international with Generatio in particular. In El Salvador, clearly the result of donating by Bitcoin is no tax because it's tender. But the challenge with any, like, tax treatment of donations is you can only use like charitable tax receipts in a jurisdiction that you've received income in, right? So if a foreign donor donates to a Canadian charity, like, that tax receipt's not going to be useful to them unless they're making money in Canada. So there's a whole lot of charities. There's not a lot of consistency in regulation country to country. It differs quite substantially, especially between common law and civil law countries. And it's really interesting to take a look at that and then also try to pair it with Bitcoin. That is something that has, you know, these immutable rules that don't change from place to place. But yeah, that's somewhere I'd like to go with my research and see where it's treated in a more friendly way, because I think jurisdictions that choose to be friendly to Bitcoin from a philanthropy perspective actually be really interesting as, let's say, headquarters for international charities, right? If you get a big international charity that's got whatever 10 or 15 arms in different countries, you know, hopefully doing good things, not so good things, then I'd want to encourage them to take up an office in a jurisdiction that's friendly if they're going to take Bitcoin seriously, kind of over the long run and as an international strategy.
I mean, as I'm listening to you, I can't help but feel that this is like a missed opportunity for the Liberal Party to have sandbagged their own charitable friends running different.
Well, I mean, that's the challenge. That's the challenge of the sector, right? I mean, it's most people. Vast majority of people, both professional advisors, donors, and people working in the sector, have good intentions. But you really, you know, you sort of wear your values on your sleeve, and you sort of know where people are coming from. And obviously there are value judgments associated with that. And anybody can look at, you know, my take on things and say, oh, like, that's good, or vice versa. And so I think there's a real opportunity kind of in Bitcoin adjacent professional circles for us as professional advisors to sort of come together and craft an ethos that isn't necessarily like prescriptive, right? That's not to tell you, Scott, like, this is the charity you should donate to and that's the one you should not, that sort of thing. But a set of advisors that at least have some common principles that are Bitcoin adjacent and that people feel that they might want to engage with, that they might want to be open to, you know, let's say a Bitcoin philanthropy conversation about. Because I think the fear, rightly so, from a lot of Bitcoiners might be, well, you know, the whole charitable sector is just a bunch of sellouts. Like, I've got no interest in that. And my first answer to that is no. Like, there are lots of, you know, I could rhyme off, you know, lots of my clients would be happy to meet you, actually. But the second answer to it is, if you actually think that you're not interested in the charitable sector, then don't go through formal charity regulation routes. Like, then don't worry about your tax receipt and don't worry about the tax consequences. If what you want is to build something with your Bitcoin and you want to build something good, like philanthropic in the descriptive sense, not in like the regulatory sense, then go ahead and do it and take the route of something like patronage, which is where some of my thought has been going more recently, of like, forget whether you're going to get a tax receipt for this thing. If your motivation truly is, I've got Bitcoin and I see, you know, part of the world going to hell in a handbasket and I want to do something about it. It's like, okay, go, like, do it, and maybe find some professional advisors to help you navigate that if you need it. But if you want to, I mean, it reminds me of your presentation in El Salvador, right? If you're sick of like ugly buildings everywhere, or cookie cutters everywhere, or badly built housing that is making people's suburban lives miserable, then like, forget about finding like the charitable avenue for affordable housing or whatever. Go endow something. Go like find somebody with the ideas, the energy, the skills, whatever, to build the thing you want and back them. You know, like if you do that with an artist, John and I have talked about this a few times, a single modest size Bitcoin donation could endow an artist's career indefinitely. If sort of well-structured at the beginning and well-managed over time, we have this opportunity with Bitcoin in a way that we haven't had with money for, you know, literally for centuries. And I think I get the sense that certain earlier generations of Bitcoiners are starting to turn their attention to that. For John and I as professional advisors, it's sort of natural that we ask that question because we see it in clients who are wealthy. At some point, the question comes in some form, you know, if I've got more than I need, what am I going to do with it? And the answer might be just sit on it. But for a lot of people, that's not the answer. And we're starting to see Bitcoin sort of asking that question. Like, okay, like once I'm taken care of, my family's taken care of, and I've had all the fun in the world and there's still left over, like, yeah, maybe I'd like my name associated with something good, but like, I don't know what that looks like. So it's really fun to be in this corner of the space because it feels pretty emergent. You know, if I go into other conversations that are sort of more technical around Bitcoin, I'm out of my league. They, you know, people have history and block wars that I know nothing about, and that, you know, I sort of defer to them. But in this little corner, you know, I feel like there's stuff to be thought about, and people like me and John and some of our colleagues are having a lot of fun helping people explore what comes after custody, right? After custody, after your estate plan, there's a whole world of kind of legacy building that is available, whether it's through the charitable sector proper or kind of more generally a personal cause.
Yeah, the idea of a donation that grows forever should be something that is very appealing to people who have charitable inclinations. And I can't help but think like, this idea is going to catch on. So I think what you guys are up to is very cool. One of the other things I was thinking about while you were talking there is, I mean, maybe another potential challenge for this is somebody like Michael Saylor, who personally holds around something like 20,000 Bitcoins. And he's already publicly announced that his donation is actually going to be back to the Bitcoin network. So when he dies, his Bitcoin will be permanently pulled out of circulation. And so he's sort of giving forward the gift of scarcity. And I wonder how many people will follow his suit or do that unintentionally.
Yeah, well, in both. Yeah. And in a sense, you know, John and I joked around that in both of those cases, you've made a plan, right? You've either planned to do it or you've like chosen not to plan. And then your plan is it happens. It happens anyway. I think there'll be lots of donations, probably more than we'd like to admit to the network, probably largely caused by human error. Some will be intentional, but to the extent that people, you know, want to choose it, they can choose it like Saylor's done, to leave it to the network. In other cases, they'll want to like leverage it in a different way. Not to make a judgment on someone like Saylor, I think there's like a really clear, like actual thought process that goes through that. I don't think people arrive at the donation to the network sort of flippantly. But something that I think a lot about is money as a category, and Bitcoin is included in that category, is really only descriptive of potential. And you might sort of challenge that. I don't want to like go toe to toe with a philosopher or somebody on this, but I think it's largely something that's potential, and the value isn't, you don't see it in the world until it's actually actualized, until it's spent, until it's leveraged, until it's moved. And so, you know, donation to the network, I guess you could say it's sort of actualized once, you know, once Sailor dies and everybody sees number go up a little bit. But I might go as far to say that doesn't actually realize its fullest potential, because has anything actually happened in the world as a result? Like, arguably not. And so I think some people have chatted sort of along this line with some Bitcoiners, and I think they think I'm a bit of a bleeding heart about it. But I definitely have a sort of a preference or a sense that we should prefer something actually resulting in the real world, something good, even, you know, if we want to bring in like a little bit of judge, the question is, you know, what do we actually mean by that? Or, you know, what is good in a particular community or place to a particular donor? Those are really big questions. But I think as Bitcoin grows as an asset that is acceptable to businesses, as money that is acceptable in more jurisdictions, we are going to see more of these questions. Okay, like, how is it used and how is it leveraged and how is it sort of deployed for the common good, in the same way that we ask about any other asset or any other, you know, currency.
Will be interesting to see how this all plays out. Andrew, maybe just as we wrap up the conversation, is there anywhere you would like to point listeners directly if they are looking to, you know, learn a little bit more about what you're up to?
Yeah, my online presence is, I'm there. It's a little spotty. I'm on and off on Twitter, PA Klubine. I'm working on having a landing page for me. It will be klubine.co. So that'll be up in the next little while. That's going to kind of collate social media, my law practice, some of my Bitcoin thinking. I'm hoping to start doing some writing on Substack in the next little while. So maybe not the day this releases, but in the short future, depending on when you're listening to this, klubine.co will be the easiest place to go.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much again for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. This is great.
Yeah, it's been a ton of fun. And if you're listening and you made it all the way to the end of the episode, I want to thank you as well for tuning in and hope to see you next week.
Take care, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits. Supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and VMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.